Community Connections CKMS. Local sounds, thoughts, passions, and success. Celebrate local. Your neighbor's got a story to tell. Community Connections CKMS.
Hello, Waterloo Region. Today is Friday, the 11th of March, 2022. You're listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. Today we're going to be talking to Martin Asling from WR Yimby about housing issues in Waterloo Region and a report issued by the Ontario government and WR Yimby's response to that. First, we're going to listen to Texas Girl at the Funeral of Her Father by Rose Brokenshire. You're listening to CKMS FM Radio 102.7. You're listening, this is CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. Today on the show, we have Martin Asling from WR Yimby.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Can you tell me a little bit about what WR Yimby is?
So Waterloo Region, Yes in My Backyard, we're an organization that formed in 2019 in order to advocate for more housing in our community, for more housing affordability, as another voice to counter the type of not in my backyard thinking that prevails in our region. And while we do often focus on housing, our concerns aren't just with NIMBYism regarding housing. We're also concerned about things like supervised consumption sites, which can be real lifesavers for people in our communities. And ultimately, those kind of decisions, you know, should be made at a broader scale, while considering the needs of people that are most affected, and so forth. Supervised consumption sites, you know, those most affected are those that are using drugs and that aren't simply going to quit tomorrow just because we might want them to, but we still have a responsibility as a community to do whatever we can to keep them as safe as possible and give them other options and opportunities to have other options to deal with the type of sometimes severe trauma that they might be dealing with. And, you know, one of the reasons people use, you know, so-called hard drugs, and particularly to a large extent, is because there's something going on. And part of helping people move forward is building the type of relationship. And part of building that relationship is having that kind of trust where you're able to help people minimize the risk and build that type of relationship. I kind of got more broadly into the supervised consumption site talk. But I think that's important to emphasize because sometimes people might think of us as just as a housing group. And I think that people that might be interested in our work simply because, you know, they might be a relatively well-off middle-class person that's nonetheless very concerned about rising housing costs, and they might identify one of those problems, I think, correctly as being that when we think about housing, particularly when we think about new housing, we think of it more as a problem rather than a solution. And we think far too locally, which often seems like a good thing, but you have to think more broadly, geographically speaking, because that would include the broader spectrum of people that are actually affected by whether or not there's a new housing development. And once you think of things in those terms, then I think it's natural to also think of, you know, if you're thinking about something like a supervised consumption site, it's not just whether or not the neighborhood wants it. The neighborhood might particularly see what they see as the downsides, but they might not see all the potential upsides that would be more broadly spread out. So once you understand that logic, that you have to think of the effect on the broader community, not just the immediate neighborhood, as much as, and I don't dismiss their concerns, but they're just not the only stakeholders, the people that we should be concerned about. So that's part of what we're trying to do, is to bridge those kind of gaps in our community, where maybe the middle class kind of person that is thinking about the high cost of housing, even for people that are middle class. I think it's important to think of how some of the same forces at play are also making life very, very difficult for people that are in much more difficult situations. Yeah. So, for example, and this is, I know we're here to talk about the Ontario Housing Affordability Task Force. Yeah. We'll one of there. The things that they recommended, which is a very good thing, I think, is allowing as of right multi-tenant homes throughout the province. And multi-tenant homes, City of Kitchener zoning bylaw calls them lodging homes. In the City of Kitchener, that's, you know, five or more people sharing a, you know, in the same building, but with some shared space, like a shared kitchen, maybe bathrooms, you know, that's a lodging home, as opposed to an apartment building where everything is onto itself, the bathroom and
same,
so forth.
Same thing as boarding houses?
They can be called lodging homes, rooming homes, boarding houses, multi-tenant homes. According to the City of Kitchener, which includes lodging homes in their bylaw, a lodging home is five or more tenants sharing, you know, aspects like a kitchen. And so as opposed to apartments, you know, on their own with their own kitchen and bathroom and so on. Lodging homes or multi-tenant homes are much more likely to be affordable immediately. And I think, you know, that's because they're shared spaces, and also because it's easier to convert something to a lodging home than it is to, you know, build an entirely new structure. And that would be another reason why they're a more immediately affordable solution to our housing crisis.
Is the rent for lodging houses typically on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, daily basis perhaps even?
I mean, if you're thinking kind of like of lodging home as the old, it has a very long tradition. So I think it can make people think of that type of place where you might be paying by night or something. But I think think of lodging home as just the term that is used for really anything that is five or more people sharing a building, like, you know, with your own room, but with shared space. So it would be just kind of typical rental with that kind of monthly rent situation.
Okay. So the name of your organization is WRYIMBY, which is a variation on NIMBY, not in my backyard. Yeah. Although you're advocating for housing and consumption sites and just generally social services, you're not actually delivering those social services, are you?
No.
Instead, you're the advocacy group to make these social services acceptable in the community.
Yes, we're an advocacy group. We actually don't have funding. We're entirely volunteer run. So we're not providers. And I think that we definitely need providers. They play a very important role in our community. But one thing that we have as an advocacy group is we're focused entirely on that. You know, that means that we can be as upfront as we want about anything. And I think that's important too, but they're all very important.
And not having any funding, you can take controversial stands because there's no fear of losing the funding that you haven't got in the first place.
Yes, and I hope that our stands are not controversial, and if they are, I hope that they're not controversial for long, because I think that, you know, ultimately, there is a pretty simple logic to what we stand for. I don't mean to say that everything's simple in housing politics. It absolutely isn't, but I think ultimately you have to also narrow things down to kind of first principles, right? And to us, the really important first principles are if you're opposing the development somewhere, where else do you want it to go? And sometimes people say, well, I have an answer to that. I want it to go in this neighborhood. But the problem is, in that neighborhood, they also don't want housing, right? I mean, the harder question is, why is it better to have housing somewhere else instead of here? And that question is often avoided because people don't think of the trade-offs and the consequences, right? Ultimately, if someone's proposing housing, that's because they believe, down the line at least, that that housing is going to be filled with people. And that means if you don't allow that housing, at least not at that scale, the people that would be there will be competing for housing somewhere else. And ultimately, that will drive up costs and that will, you know, make the newer housing that isn't that new still be the newest housing because the newer housing wasn't built or wasn't built at the scale that people actually needed it at. Yeah. So, you know, so ultimately we call for more housing overall, but in particular, we focus on things like lodging homes because they're more likely to be immediately affordable. Having said that, also, you know, if you think of the most expensive housing type on average, that's the single detached home. And what's most privileged in our zoning? Well, it's the single detached home. That's the easiest thing to have. As you get denser, there are zones where it's not allowed as of right, where there's more barriers in place before you can have that type of housing.
And so one of your points of advocacy is to advocate to municipal councils to loosen the zoning laws to allow a wider variety of housing all across the city.
Yes. So that would include townhomes, apartment buildings, mid-rises, and that kind of thing. And I think that that's really important, not just because those types of homes are more likely to include rental and more likely to be affordable over time, but you also have to think of that overall amount of housing that we have. And the easiest way to think of whether or not housing scarcity matters is if a friend tells you, oh, I'm looking for a place and I found out that there's 100 people competing for my unit, your obvious reaction and understanding is going to be, wow, that's going to be really tough to find that place at a good price because there's a lot more demand than that unit allowed.
When you talked earlier about scaling up the housing, you weren't really talking so much about quantity because, you know, we have lots of single detached houses at the moment. You were talking more about variety of accommodations.
Well, I would say I'm talking about both, right? I think as kind of getting into we have a joint letter with Hold the Line and Hold the Line as well as, and this is something we agree with them on, a Hold the Line is about maintaining the countryside line.
Yeah.
So there are avenues where when we say we want more housing, we don't mean at any cost whatsoever. Parks are important, clearly. The countryside line is important. It's important to not sprawl out into infinity. That's not a sustainable way to provide housing environmentally. It also, it might lead to kind of cheaper housing out on the outskirts, but then it means that you have to drive, and that takes up your time and takes up your money as well.
Can you give a quick explanation of what the countryside line is and how Hold the Line is involved with that?
I worry about speaking for them too much, but you know, there is a countryside line, and the idea is to not develop further than the countryside line in order to protect farmland, and also I think this is something that really resonates with us, in order to prevent urban sprawl.
And that countryside line is defined in the Region of Waterloo municipal development policies.
Yes. The region is responsible for that. And one of the challenges is that there are a lot of groups, a lot of people that also want to maintain that countryside line. And I think Hold the Line does a good job of talking about both maintaining that line and also having the types of zoning policies that make it sustainable to hold the line and make it possible to hold the line. And that means growing up instead of out.
Yeah. There's a lot of pushback from the developers on having a countryside line.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, developers want to build where they want to build. And sometimes the constraints we put are not constraints that are actually in the public interest, like with building mid-rises or townhomes throughout the city, right? We need more housing. Ultimately, the way I think about it is the reason why there is a key difference to me where I will, you know, developers might not like us if we're talking about the countryside line, but they might like us if we're advocating for more housing within cities.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the difference that I see between those two things is with the countryside line, you know, that's about limiting sprawl, and sprawl is something that negatively affects all of us, right? We are in a climate crisis, and one of the big reasons that we're in a climate crisis is that we're driving everywhere and anywhere. We need to build the kind of communities where we're less reliant on cars, and that means having denser communities. It also means not sprawling out. And so we want to do that two ways, by allowing more housing within cities and to prevent too much sprawling out. And ultimately, those are things that affect the broad community. The environment, I mean, is the ultimate issue that doesn't understand borders, right? Whereas when it comes to the, there are certainly people that don't want taller buildings or dense housing in their neighborhoods. But the difference there is whatever problems they see, and some of them are very real but very localized problems, and sometimes they're overblown because I think, you know, for example, people worry about traffic, but maybe they don't think of the extent to which a more dense development will appeal to people that don't own cars, for example, and particularly when it's close to the downtown, as it often is. If you accept that there may be more traffic in a neighborhood because of a development, if you start with that premise, that's not a broad negative consequence. That's actually just the moving of traffic where it would have potentially been otherwise to a different location. And if anything, the broad effect that affects everyone is that there's less likely to be traffic overall when you allow for more dense housing types, because it makes public transit more viable.
Yeah.
And it makes walkability more viable as well, because you have more things and more people in a smaller geographical space where you can get to more of the things you need, because
no
more
need
people around to provide it.
No need for cars, or even less need for transit if everything is right close at hand.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
The Ontario government has just recently released a report.
Yeah.
I thought it was a Waterloo Region report that had been released, but I was mistaken. Can you summarize what was in the report?
The first thing to understand about this report from the government of Ontario had kind of collected a group of people, and, you know, it was kind of some criticized it for being kind of, you know, a lot of developers and kind of not enough housing advocates from the outside. But there were also people involved with, say, Habitat for Humanity. But ultimately, this report was very specific to the issue of the lack of housing supply. Now, the report did actually, you know, in its appendix, talk about other things that can and should be done. And I think those were, you know, worthy parts where I would go further. But ultimately, we believe that supply is just one piece of the puzzle, particularly when it comes to the more deep affordability, where it makes sense to simply provide that housing or provide subsidies to people, however you want to do it. People that are most economically the least income and wealth. Yeah. And I think it's important to support them directly through housing subsidies or subsidized housing directly.
Yeah.
This report doesn't deal with that because that wasn't what the report was tasked with. To me, that doesn't mean that the recommendations in the report aren't also valuable, but they're limited. They're limited by the Ontario government's mandate that they gave them.
Right.
So it's important to talk about the broader spectrum, but this report talks about the supply of housing, and it has some good recommendations, particularly when it comes to having as of right zoning of 6 to 11 stories on transit routes with no minimum parking requirements. That's so, recommendation 9. If you're
we'll have a link to the report and the Hold the Line and WREMB reply to that from on our website, radiowaterloo.ca/CCC, and scroll down to today's episode. You'll be able to get all those links on the website.
To mention two other recommendations that we would strongly support would be the as-of-right residential zoning. So that's up to 4 units and 4 stories, as-of-right secondary suites and rooming houses, lodging homes, multi-tenant homes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really important to have at least some measure of density throughout our cities. That's really important, particularly because one of the big problems with our zoning, we have kind of this idea that we have these different zones where we allow for different types of housing. And it's kind of taken for granted that we have different zones, and different zones should have different levels of density. And we need zoning to maintain that. And you often hear talks about neighborhood character in stable residential neighborhoods as kind of almost inherently positive things that need no further debate, right? Neighborhoods need to maintain their character. We need to maintain these stable neighborhoods. But I have a big problem with that. And a big part of that comes from the push for what's often called exclusionary zoning or economic zoning, particularly if you look at the United States, but you can see it in Canada as well, with, you know, influential planners like Harlan Bartholomew, who comes from way back, but he was quite a racist person who wanted to use basically economic zoning to kind of have the type of segregation that was no longer viable.
The redlined districts.
Yeah, ultimately, when people talk about redlined districts, it's not just about redlining. Redlining is an important part of it, but a big part of why you have these districts that are segregated by race and income. And, you know, that still exists to some extent. the reason why you have those is that when, so for example, in the United States, when explicitly racist zoning was no longer allowed, was no longer constitutionally viable, that's when you had this push towards economic zoning, this push towards saying this neighborhood has to be ownership, single detached homes, not dense. This neighborhood can have apartment buildings. The neighborhoods that were allowed to have apartment buildings, those were the historically, you know, majority black neighborhoods, whereas the majority white neighborhoods were more likely to be single detached. Now, you might look hear that and say, well, that was then, this is now. We have our own reasons for doing things now. Ultimately, if you had that type of strategy, and if you use that same type of strategy, that same type of policy, where you have some neighborhoods which are where you allow much less density than others, and those neighborhoods tend to be wealthier often. If that worked for the very, you know, vile aim of maintaining racial segregation and income segregation, then I think it should give you a lot of pause if you're thinking that what we have now is simply the way it is, right? I think one of the important insights from the anti-racist movement is that it doesn't matter so much what you feel your motivation is now. What matters is the consequences. One of the reasons we have concepts like structural racism, and I think this is also, you know, racism by way of classism and kind of maintaining these whatever.
Yeah, the segregation of the zoning. Yeah, and how does this Ontario report address that kind of segregation?
So they talk a little bit about the disparate impacts of not having enough housing and how it disproportionately harms people that are younger, people that are newer to Canada, people that are less likely to be older, whiter, wealthier. So it talks a little bit about that. It doesn't talk about it a ton. I think it could have talked about it a lot more, but it does mention it. And what they propose ultimately is the kinds of things that I mentioned. I think that allowing much more dense housing in so-called stable neighborhoods. I wouldn't say it's much more dense housing. I mean, the recommendations are still pretty, they're saying up to 4 units and 4 stories, as of right, secondary suites and rooming homes.
What does that mean, as of right? I saw that mentioned in the letter.
As of right, yes. Yeah. So as of right, kind of zoning parlance. So you might have a zone where a certain housing type, say townhomes, are not allowed as of right. And it doesn't necessarily mean you can never have that type of housing. So, you know, you can apply for a variance for maybe changing the height limit of something that you want to build. And you see that happening all the time. And whenever there's a story about a building that people don't want at a certain height and all this kind of controversy surrounding it, that's usually because they're asking for a variance. Something wasn't allowed as of right. It's an important subtlety to recognize that if something isn't allowed as of right, it doesn't mean that it's not going to be allowed, period. However, having said that, the process by which you ask for a variance, go to meetings, hear from neighbors that are often vehemently opposed to an additional 1 or 2 stories, it's still a significant barrier. When someone's saying as of right, they mean it's not something that you need an additional variance for. And I think that's an important thing. So to allow a certain type of housing...
Yeah.
Where it's not something that you need to go to a bunch of meetings where people are very upset and angry at even the slightest increase in density.
It sure seems to me that an awful lot of council meeting time is taken up by variance requests and then the delegations opposing those variance requests.
Yeah, yes.
So if this is just built into the housing policy in the first place, that would prevent a whole bunch of that essentially wasted time by councils.
Yes. And one of the recommendations, and this is something that we have, I think, in the joint letter, there's kind of a nuanced take on it. It is kind of under the bad, but I think if you read what we say about it, we identify some of the issues with the status quo. So the recommendation by the task force is to limit the number of meetings, of such meetings, to kind of what is already the minimum in the Planning Act. So don't go over those number of meetings. The issue there is, I think that this requires a broader conversation, because the way we often talk and think about these planning issues, and when we think of these localized questions, is we think of, you know, having meetings and such as allowing for more democratic engagement. And in one sense, that's clearly true. You know, you can simply say the more engagement, the better. The more chance councillors get to hear from their constituents how they feel about something, that seems like a very positive thing. And I think for that reason, we were both hesitant to kind of support a calling for less meetings without a broader conversation of what that means. Because ultimately, Waterloo Region, Yimby, you know, myself in particular, I feel that in a lot of ways, having these conversations at this very small scale is in a lot of ways less democratic, because if a developer asks for a variance because they want to build more housing than is allowed as of right, the people that would be affected by more housing are pretty spread out throughout the community, right? And they might hypothetically be either moving into that new building, or, you know, they could also be affected by the fact that someone else moves in, and that means that they're not going to be competing for that person for housing.
So as people move into this new housing, those are people who are not currently living in that particular community area but are affected by it. And then the housing that gets freed up and becomes available to others is also an effect of new housing development somewhere else.
Yeah. So, I mean, the people that are affected in that sense, they might live in the neighborhood, they might not, they might live in the city, they might live in the region, they might even live outside the region. Regardless, they should still have standing as far as people that should be listened to. But when we focus the conversation so much on this new development, in some ways it's, you know, the way we talk about things, but even when it's unintentional, it still has that effect because we're talking about one development at a time. If we're talking more broadly as a community, how much housing do you want? You often find that people are much more supportive of housing when that question is asked more broadly, when it's asked as an overall question, not simply in your neighborhood. So there's a concept of collective action problem, right? Where I might benefit from this overall increase in housing, right?
But you don't want it in your backyard.
Right. But when it's in my backyard, I see whatever I see as the potential negatives, I see them very immediately. I see this, you know, I imagine this tall building that's not there yet, but I see tall buildings nearby. I think of the traffic. I think of the noise. I think of all the things that affect me directly. Whereas when I think of the benefits, they're spread out, and, you know, I get a small bit of that benefit.
Yeah.
So the problem is, even though I can understand in a broader sense that, well, these debates are happening all throughout the region, and maybe I would benefit from, if we could all agree to just allow more housing, we would all benefit because we would get those broader benefits of more housing affordability, as well as other benefits of, you know, living in a city with other people, you know, opportunities and things like that. But when it's building by building, it's those immediate negative or seemingly negative effects. So that the kind of collective action problem is you have that disconnect between what you know might or may not know, but what might be best for all and what is best for you in that one example. And the way to kind of address those collective action problems, I think, with the zoning is to have those conversations more broadly. So you're not just thinking of the negative effects on you of one development, but of the entire effect on the entire community of allowing for more housing. And it kind of forces you to think of it as actually a political thing, which there was one line in the report talking about taking politics out of it. In some ways, I think it's actually taking politics in. We think of politics as a negative, but what I mean is a recognition that these are broad debates that have effects on a broad number of people. It's not just, well, what are the consequences for my neighborhood? Yeah. What are the overall effects? And there are winners and losers, but ultimately the winners of housing scarcity are the, you know, homeowners that see rapid increases in their property values, whereas renters and people looking to get into the market, people that are less well off are the losers.
I'm not sure how much that increase in property value really has an effect, because if you were to leverage that additional value in your house by selling it, you have to buy another house at an equally inflated price. I'm not really sure.
That is a good point. And I think that's something that's sometimes understood, but maybe not all the time. I think there's a lot of fear when it comes to property values. People are very risk averse, particularly when it comes to things like property values. So they're very fearful of anything that might lower their property values, even though property values have been increasing for quite a while now. But I think that is a very good point, that in some ways homeowners benefit, but it's kind of like golden handcuffs in a way. You're absolutely right. You can sell your home, but then what are you going to buy? Yeah.
There's another point in your letter about tribunal fees.
Yes. There is a problem where the risk of taking something to tribunal can very much delay and prevent much needed housing. So, I mean, that's the reasoning behind increasing the tribunal fees. I think this is kind of a problem overall. Whenever you're trying to use fees as a means of changing someone's behavior or preventing someone from doing something, the challenge is that, you know, that will affect those that are less well off much more than it affects those that are well off.
Yeah.
So they do call for increasing the fees for bring something to a tribunal, because basically you're challenging a development, changing that from 400 to 10,000, which is quite a large increase. And it's meant to reflect the fact that, well, for one thing, with a tribunal, unlike in a court, you can't say if the developer wins, the ruling can't be that then those that are challenging the development at the tribunal have to pay their legal fees. Yeah. So there's kind of that issue. Yeah. But ultimately, I think we have to think harder about how do you actually limit these types of problems in a way that's more egalitarian in its outcomes and its way of thinking about mm-hmm. things. I think that allowing more housing as of right is really important in that respect, that there aren't so many challenges just for trying to increase the supply of housing. Yeah. But with the tribunal fees, and this is not something where everyone that kind of identifies as YIMBY might agree with, but I think ultimately increasing the size of the tribunal fee, it probably won't affect those that are more well off that can still scrounge up that amount of money. And then, of course, there's their own legal yeah. fees as well. Whereas it might make a difference for people that are less able to yeah. scrounge up money. So
if there's more housing as of right in order to prevent these long council meetings where there's variance requests and objections, if there's more housing as of right available, wouldn't that increase the people going to tribunal because they have no recourse at the local municipal council any longer to address their objections?
Right. I was thinking of more broadly the kind of barriers towards building housing. So, I mean, I think, yeah, I do think it's kind of a problem that needs addressing. I'm not sure if the fee is the right tool to do that, but it's not something that I'm that certain about, but it is.
Won't know until it happens. The letter from WRIMB and Hold the Line has an interesting answer to that, the Local Planning Appeals Support Center.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the Local Planning Appeals Support Center was something where the funding was cut.
It no longer exists, does it?
Yes. So cut to that extent, yes. That's something that existed under the previous government, and it gave the opportunity to educate people on process. And in some ways, that might help people that are looking to appeal, that are looking to challenge a development. But at the same time, the hope here is particularly if we require appellants to consult with the Local Planning Appeal Support Center before going to tribunal, it can help, as we say, it scope their objections to the issues that truly have bearing on the application in question. So I think that there's that opportunity there with that Local Planning Appeal Support Center, if it's brought back. You know, maybe someone comes and they have a concern. Maybe after talking with the center, with the experts there, they might understand that it's not actually, you know, something a valid thing to bring to tribunal. And that can save everyone time. That can save them time. That can save people that are looking to move into this new housing time. It can save the entire system time. So there's that opportunity that could potentially lead to less frivolity in tribunals.
Right, right. Let's turn to what's actually happening in Waterloo Region at the moment. There's been lots and lots and lots of development going on.
Yeah.
Has it actually resulted in an increase of the housing supply? And has it resulted in an increase of a desirable housing supply?
Well, I think there are a few things that you have to consider first. I mean, I kind of agreed almost reflexively, but it's true to a certain extent. There is a lot of a certain type of development in a certain geographical area that is being developed. And that's kind of part of a longstanding regional policy and just focus, which is of development near light rail transit. There's still a lot of instances where there isn't development, even along the transit lines, where there's still significant pockets where it's much less dense than you would expect or want to have near transit. And then on top of that, you have all the areas where it's still very low-rise residential. Sometimes you hear people say, in reference to Kitchener-Waterloo and Toronto, where there are a lot of cranes, there's a lot of tall buildings being built in a very specific geographical area. And the kind of reflexive thing to say, and a lot of people have said this, just to quote a Trumpism, you know, just look out the window and you'll see lots of developments, you'll see lots of cranes. Well, that's true. But what you really need to be asking yourself is look at the increase in demand. Is that demand being met?
Yeah. I think being met for a segment of the population that isn't actually using that development for housing. I've heard a statistic that as much as 1/3 of those condominium high-rise towers are sitting empty because they're being used as investments rather than to actually house people.
Yeah, so I have a few things to say about that. First of all, I think the role of investment in housing is very important. sometimes the topic of investment in housing is used to minimize the importance of supply. And you've seen a couple UW planners, including Brian Doucette, mm-hmm. Talk about that in the Waterloo Region Record and elsewhere. So a few things to say. First of all, when we talk about empty homes, we have to be more specific. So sometimes the statistics on empty homes, they include cases where the owner isn't living in the unit, but maybe they're renting it out. If they're renting it out, that is still housing for people. In fact, we need rental housing. We desperately need rental housing.
Yeah.
But focusing entirely on, say, cases where someone is holding onto it for investment and not renting it out, I think you have to ask yourself, first of all, what kind of scenario would it be where that's a profitable thing to do? You make money by renting things out. You must be so confident that the unit will continue to increase in price at enough of a rate where it's not even worth it financially to rent it out, because there's risk there with renting it out. But you get a pretty steady income if you rent it out. So, I think for that to even happen, for that to be a possibility, the problem already has to be there, which is the predictable increase in cost of housing. So you probably heard of Blackstone, of course, which has been buying up single detached homes in the United States. And their subsidiary Invitation Homes, they had their filing at the Securities and Exchange Commission. And this is where you're speaking to your investors, right? You better have a good argument and something solid to say to your investors, otherwise they lose confidence in you. So what they said to their investors at the Securities and Exchange Commission through their filing is that they will continue to invest in areas that are high demand and low supply. And they identify increases to supply as the risk. So I definitely agree that empty homes are a problem if they are truly empty homes and not rented out.
Right.
I definitely agree that the role of investment in housing is a problem. The part that I disagree with is the suggestion that you sometimes hear that means that supply isn't that important. I think ultimately, what it means, if some of the homes are empty, that means that we're still not addressing the supply nearly as much as we need to.
If these units are being rented out, it still hasn't fully addressed the issue of available rental housing. There's an article on the CBC just this past week or so saying that the cost of rental is skyrocketing as much as the cost of actual ownership is. And so there's a lot of this renoviction taking place, people being evicted with the alleged reason for the unit needs renovation, or that they're being evicted because allegedly family members are moving in. And I've actually seen on the social media that is actually being blamed on organizations like YIMBY advocating for additional housing. And then when it comes to market, it's coming to market at unaffordable prices. Can you give a quick response to that?
I just want to make sure I understand the argument fully first. So
I'm not sure that I understood the argument myself, to be honest.
I understand the argument that I'm responding to, because I've heard variations of that, but I just want to make sure that I'm responding to what you've heard or what you feel is...
Essentially, blaming increased rental costs on the activism of organizations looking for additional rental housing, causing the market to spike because of the increased demand caused by advocacy groups like YIMBY.
So the increased demand for housing,
which is causing people to, landlords to do renovictions and evictions for family members, allegedly, and then turning it over again a few months later at double, triple the original rental price, having displaced people from a low-income rental to unaffordable rentals.
So, it's not a position I agree with. I think one of the best ways to talk about that maybe is there was a recent development proposal where, ultimately, one of the reasons why we want more housing is that, we recognize that there is a large demand for housing. With more housing to begin with, that demand for housing is less likely to displace existing housing. If you build new housing, if you build 100 units, that's 100 people that would otherwise be competing with others for housing and greater incentivizing landlords of a particular building to renovate the people that are already living there because they can make a lot more money because they know that demand is there. To use kind of one example, there was a development that I believe it was on Mill Street. And this was an example where the developer wanted to convert, there were some homes there, some rental homes that would be removed to build a condo so-called tower and some townhomes. And we had, as a YIMBY organization, we had mixed feelings about that particular development because we knew that that exact development would directly lead to the displacement of people. We also understood that without that development, the people that would have been living in that development would be competing with other people for housing, which would likely also lead to displacement. Probably just because of the math of it, there being many more people that are currently housed in that area, it would probably lead to more displacement.
So what are you to do? This sounds like an impossible situation with no solution. That's
right. So when we spoke to council, Kevin White spoke at council, and he basically said that we're very concerned about the displacement, but we also recognize that this housing also provides a need and probably will prevent further displacement elsewhere. The one line which we said, which I think I very much stand by, is where we said the worst case scenario would be if this housing is allowed to go forward, but only if it's less housing, because ultimately that's what the zoning does. It's not designed to protect tenants from displacement. It's designed to protect neighborhood character, to maintain to have buildings look more alike to each other, to be of similar height and so on. And so we said the worst case scenario would be if nothing is done for the tenants, it's still going to be converted to something else, but we don't allow the variances. We limit the increases in height and so on. The developer went to council and said, okay, I have a proposal now that is, you know, just the townhomes. It was a dramatic decrease in the number of units. No change in the displacement at all. So that's what happened in that case. And the reason why that happened is that the tools that we have are not designed to protect tenants. They're designed to, you know, protect the aesthetics of our neighborhood so that, you know, you don't have to see a so-called monstrosity.
Which doesn't do people searching for housing any good at all.
Yeah. I think that ultimately part of it's, it's just kind of an empirical question, and I can kind of...
Yeah.
I could maybe email you some links that you want to put on.
Do that.
In the background that, you know, that...
Tell people quickly how to get a hold of you, because we are actually out of time. We've been doing this for an hour, so how can people get a hold of WRYIMBY?
Yeah, so if you want to get a hold of us, the best ways are just to go to... You can either message us on Facebook. We're at Waterloo Region YIMBY on Facebook. You can message us on Twitter, Waterloo Region YIMBY, or you can email us at waterlooregionyimby.org.
I'll have it all on the webpage.
WRYIMBY.
Yeah. Go to radiowaterloo.ca/ccc to get all the information, and then it'll be there for you. Hopefully we'll have this up as a podcast, as a vidcast, in fairly short order. You've been listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Junk. We've been talking to Martin Asling from WRYIMBY.com, Yes in My Backyard, about housing issues in Waterloo region and across the province. CKMS Community Connections is sponsored by Radio Waterloo. Executive producer is Jennifer Strong. My name is Bob Jonkman. Next Friday, we'll have all new music, including the new album from The Boys and I. See you next week.